I'm Philip. I'm an alcoholic. I was told by Ben, if I mess this up, not to let Matt, let you know that my sponsor is Matt H. So, you know, if I mess this up, Matt H. is my sponsor. So my home group is the Maladjusted to Life group. And it says here on page 76, we have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. We are now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we had admitted are objectionable. Can he now take them all away, every one? If we are still, if we still cling to something, we will not let go. We ask God to help us be willing. When ready, we say something like this: "My Creator, I am now willing to have, willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and to my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen." And I present to you John E.
John, alcoholic.
John.
I thought I was nervous. Jesus, Philip. I mean, that was painful just sitting there watching my brother. I would normally, like, roast you, but I just... can't even do that. Thanks, Matt, for asking me. Thanks for the committee, everything they've done. These things don't just happen, you know, by accident. It takes a lot of work, and usually it's the committee chair that gets the thanks, but it's the people back there doing registration and making coffee and filling up waters and stuff like that that, you know, really make this thing happen. So thank you. And thanks to our taper. Everybody says that, but they've always played a big part in my recovery, and you'll hear some of that. But, you know, when Leslie was talking about it, early in sobriety, I had like, I got sober young. My sobriety date is July 5th, 1989. I was a year and a half old, and I was very fortunate. I got sober with a bunch of young people. I mean, there was loads of young people where I got sober in Maryland. And they were having the Maryland State Convention in the fall. So I got sober in July. So I don't know, this is August, September, October, something like that. And Cliff Roach was coming to talk. And I said, I don't care, you know. They just, you know the deal, right? Just get in the car. And I went up there, and it was a big room. It was probably 500 people, and everyone laughed their tails off all night long. I mean, Cliff Roach will make you laugh. And I didn't think anything was funny. I mean, there was not one line where he laughed, you know, that I laughed. I mean, I just was stone-faced. I was not going to have a good time, much less get anywhere close to recovery. You know, I'm just biding time. And at the end, walking out, I was really disturbed that everybody was laughing and I wasn't laughing. And I had $5. And back then, old man talk, back then, $5 would get you 2 packs of cigarettes and a gallon of gas, maybe a gallon and a half, depending what city you were in. And that was, and I said, man, I need to get this talk. I got to figure this out. You know, why are these people laughing so hard? And it was a big dilemma, you know, 2 packs of cigarettes and a gallon of gas or this AA talk. And I bought the AA talk and I listened to it for a year and a half straight. Every night I'd listen to it to fall asleep because I just couldn't turn my brain off. And I mean, I could probably tell you Cliff Roach's story right now from start to finish. You know, Oceanside, where's that? You know, and so you guys have saved my life. And you know, really, they're the archivist of the day, right? I mean, they're recording our history. So thanks. But, you know, I do have a little bone to pick with Matt. So he's like, hey, he calls me and says, you know, Bob B was going to come down and talk, and he canceled. You know, like to see, you know, can you fill in? And, you know, Bob's one of my heroes. It's okay to have AA heroes. He's not, you know, not an idol. He's one of my heroes. And So I was like, yeah, yeah, you know. And then he says, I said, what's, you know, what are we doing? And he said, oh, he was doing 6 and 7. And I was like, oh, 6 and 7. And everybody that I've talked to this weekend who has met said, oh, you know, you're a speaker. Look at your tag. What are you talking on? 6 or 7? And they go, oh, like, ugh. Sorry to hear that, you know. And so I was so nervous, like, you know, Bob's one of my heroes. Like, you know, you got to find somebody that you can, besides your sponsor, because he's going to die or get drunk, but you got to find somebody else too, right? Like, somebody you can follow. Like, AA is full of, like, just a plethora of awesome communicators, and but some I don't really hear, you know. I mean, carrying awesome messages, I just don't hear them, but I hear Bob, and so it was a big honor for me, you know. And I called my sponsor. I said, Scott, you're not going to believe this. Like, they asked me to fill in for Bob. He laughed, and he said, no, they didn't. I said, no, I just talked to Matt. Like, when we get him on the phone, like, let's, Matt, tell him. I said, John, they had an empty slot, and they asked you to fill it. You know, we'll talk a lot about character defects in the next hour, but, you know, my ego is like, the committee sat around and said, who most resembles Bob? You know? It's John from Lebanon, you know? So he took me off the hook and didn't give me any sympathy. And so about an hour later, I'm in the car with my wife. We're driving to the doctor. She doesn't let me go to the doctor anymore by myself. And it's part of getting old. You know, Leslie was talking about the book for, you know, what was it, Getting Old Gracefully in Sobriety or something like that. I'm ready for it to be written because I'm not getting old gracefully. I'm hoping Steve will write it. Steve's got the mic next, so I got to be careful. But, so, you know, my wife doesn't let me go to the doctor by myself because, you know, last time I went to the doctor by myself, you know, she came back and she's like, well, what'd they say? Everything fine? I was like, yeah, everything's fine. And she's like, well, what do you say? I said, this is good. You know, like, I'm not big on the whole descriptions, you know, of the doctor. And anyway, so we're going to the doctor, and I said, hey, you know, what are you doing this weekend? You know, can we come with me? You know, she's my road dog. And she's like, well, I can't. I'm doing this thing with my girls. And she said, what are you talking on? I said, 6 and 7. And she laughed, like you guys laughed. I'm like, well, it's not really funny. And, I mean, you know, there's, opened up the book, right? You get a paragraph, and you know, on each, and, you know, so the cool part is, like, you can just start making stuff up about 6 and 7. Nobody really knows it. You can just say it's related to 6 and 7. But she said, I said, she goes, oh, that's easy. You know, I'm like, oh, that's easy. And she said, honey, just tell them how God's worked in your life. And because that's what 6 and 7 is about. Tell them about how God's worked in your life. Tell them about how he's cleaned up all the mistakes you've made. You have a lot of those. I'm just like, I'm not exactly sure that's what she said, but I heard that, you know. She is, matter of fact, she's right down the road from here, tubing with a bunch of her girls at the Hussa Wussa, used to be a Hussy Wussy River. What's it called? What's it called? The Owasi River. And I'll tell you how much my wife loves me. She called me last night, and she said, we had a meeting last night, and she said, you know, I told my girls, you know, that you were a little nervous about talking about 6 and 7, and we all prayed for you, you know. So find yourself some road dogs. My wife's my road dog, and I couldn't be more thankful for that. And so, you know, my sponsor didn't give me any sympathy, and my wife did not give me any sympathy. So I called Cliff, and because Chrissy had sent me the thing. This might have been the next day. I say, Cliff, you know, I hear we're going to be together in a couple weeks. And he said, yeah. And I said, I see you're doing 2 and 3. He said, not a chance. Not a chance. Well, I'm not switching with you, brother. That's all on you. So, I don't know, man. I don't know how my guys have put up with me. I really like, we do a men's retreat in Maryland, where I'm from, where I got sober. It's outside of Maryland, but it got started in Maryland, called Step Brothers. And Sheldon led it for us a couple years ago. And something he said has rocked me since I heard him say it. He said it's all 6 and 7. All the steps are 6 and 7. And to some degree, I really agree with that, right? Like, It's all about this kind of circling back and refocusing on this God deal. You know, for me, it's this catapult to get back into the cleaning business and get back on the path of God. You know, Bill says at the beginning of six, you know, this is the step that separates the men from the boys. You know, and I'm sure when I first read that, I was like, all right, let's talk about eight. You know, let's just keep going. And you know, Steve said something to me the other day. You know, he's like, I don't know how we were talking about it, but he said, you know, in some senses, it doesn't need to be any more complicated than it is in the book. Certainly, not much more is necessary just to go on, right? Like, you know, we don't figure this six and seven thing out any more than we figure out, you know, really any other steps. You know, obviously, there's some steps with some concrete instructions. You know, and I failed to thank our previous speakers, Leslie. I'm sorry the committee didn't give you more time to talk about five. You can't do four and five in an hour. You know, I wanted to hear you do more on five, but. And Cliff crushed it, and last night was really good. I had a tough time listening last night. You know, I was thinking about right now. And, you know, but last night, like, your love of Alcoholics Anonymous was just pouring out of you, and it just made me feel like I'm at home. You know, I'm with my people. So thank you for that. So, you know, in thinking about six and seven, I think you got to talk about, like, what are the prerequisites? You know, if I'm struggling with a step, I got to look at the previous step. You know, you have a sponsee that says, oh, I'm having trouble with three. You know, I believe you're having trouble with two. You know, it's a concept deal, right? Like, and I get that. You know, I had a I'm going to talk a lot about second surrender, but it's probably, you know, my 22nd surrender in sobriety. But I had a huge meltdown in sobriety where I just, you know, lit a nuclear bomb in my life. And I'm going to talk a lot about that because in hindsight, and that was at about 18 years of sobriety. And so since that point, I've had, you know, 18 years and 18 more years of sobriety. And like, I feel like I've had, you know, Richard Rohr talks about the two halves of life. I think I've had like, you know, two halves of sobriety. I'm hoping to get another third, you know, to get a little closer to this deal. You know, but when I first looked at six and seven in my early sobriety, I only had two problems with six and seven. It's the word entirely and the word all. You know, I am partially ready to have God remove most of these character defects. You know, I mean that. Like, I like what Sheldon says, that it's all six and seven, but I think all of these steps are divinely designed by God to remove what's blocking me from him and to sentence. And they're all a little bit different, right? Like, they're all, you know, the first step, second step, they all have this little, it's like this stained glass window with 12 pieces in it, you know, and as the sun rises, you know, the light comes through differently each time, you know, and each one involves some work, you know. But six, there's not this palatable work. You know, I can't get out this pad, you know, this white pad with black pen. You know, I force my way through the work. I can't, like, how do you get entirely ready if you're not? How do you get entirely ready if you're not? The same way you when a guy says, you know, I'm having a tough time with the third step, how do I do it? The only answer I got, you know, is kind of, well, go manage your life some more, you know. Come back until you're ready to turn it over, you know, or we go look at two. And so if I'm having if I'm having trouble with six, with this entirely part, which I was, I mean, like, you know, what blocks me in the sixth step is this idea that, like, if I really let go of all these character defects, I mean all of them, not just 99%, if I get rid of all of them, I really won't get what I want out of life. Because that's what I had, you know, even in sobriety, you know, I didn't have this adult life before I got here. I got here as a kid, you know, like the spiritual awakening was what happened at the Grateful Dead concerts in the parking lot. You know, that's a spiritual awakening. You know, when I got here, you couldn't convince me that that's what I needed. You know, I just needed, you know, get the girl and get, you know, get my own place and get a decent job, maybe a driver's license, you know, it's optional to have a driver's license, you know, maybe some insurance type of deal. And then, my, you know, if I can fix these problems, I'll be okay. And so I didn't have this adult life experience. I mean, I had plenty of experience of my character defects not working. I mean, you don't wind up, first time I was introduced to AA was 16 years old, you know, and I wasn't ready, you know. But so I think some of it for me, it just takes age, just takes time, you know, to really use up these character defects where I'm like, you know, I'm just done with them. I'm just done as can be. You know, I remember like having about, I don't know, somewhere 10, 12, 13, 14 years of sobriety. I was kind of, you know, in between sponsors, which means sponsoring yourself. And, but I picked up to this guy, Melvin, who was just, and I had this little bad habit of gambling too much. And, I mean, we went bankrupt, but whatever, it's, you know, maybe not a habit quite, you know, but like in the middle of that, I'm talking, you know, I know this is a problem, right? You know, and I know it causes me to do things I don't want to do. And I remember Melvin talking to me. He said, John, you know, why don't you just talk to your wife about it? Why don't you bring her into the solution and maybe she'll help you be accountable? I thought, well, Jesus Christ, if I tell her about it, I'm going to have to stop, you know, like, I mean, so, you know, this idea, like, if I don't have these character defects to some extent, like, how do you enjoy life? Like, you know, I mean, I like the religious people, you know, but like, God, I like to get my freak on too, you know, like, I mean, I don't, you know, like Cliff said, you know, I just get in trouble for thinking things. And, you know, so, in looking back, like, and at the time I probably thought I was entirely ready. You know, I just didn't know any better. The old belief that was driving this that I really stems from this kind of second step concept, you know, that God, you know, is kind of half interested in me. Yeah, God's there, you know, but does he really want me to be happy, joyous, and free? You know, because like I said, I was young when I get here, and so I think this thing is about, okay, I got to stay sober, but like now I got to go achieve. I got to go conquer the world, you know. Like, you know, Bill talks about happy, joyous, and free, you know, and my problem is, you know, I get happiness and pleasure confused. And so I start chasing pleasure, you know, I wanted the character defects removed that are keeping me from a mansion and a Mercedes, you know. I want the character defects removed that are keeping my wife from behaving the way I want her to behave. Let's leave it at that. You know, because I had this, like, I could do the math. I had this job. I've always been a salesman. Part of my character defects, I've always been a salesman. Because if you can do really well, you can be a bad employee. Right? Like, I've worked at a couple printing shops over the years, three of them, and very quickly I became the best salesman they had. Not because I have a great work ethic, trust me, I don't. Not because I have some, like, you know, moral high ground of, you know, honest days pay for an honest, like, no, I'm not interested in that either. Like, if I am the top producer, you cannot tell me what to do. I can come late, I can leave it, so like I like to come in at 9:30, I'm going to bust my tail for about 2 hours. 11:30, I'm going to the noon meeting, see my boys, have a long lunch, come back to the office about 2, I'm going to work real hard to about 3, I'm going to leave, I'm going to stop at the way home, play a round of golf, get home about 7:30, you know, I want to help my wife before she puts the kids to bed at 7:35, you know, and then let her go to the 8 o'clock AA meeting. You know, I mean, I'm killing it, you know, and I'm making good money, you know. I mean, back then, you know, it was good money, you know. It was, I don't know, $100,000 or something. And so I do the math, and I say, all right, if I can work 3 hours a day and make 100, why don't I work 6 hours and make 200? You know, so those are the character defects I want removed, not the ones that are blocking me from God. You know, I want the ones that are keeping me from what John wants. You know, at the end of 6, what Bill says separates the men from the boys is, this is the litmus test, are we going to follow this self-determined objective or the perfect objective? You know, and I have no idea what the perfect objective really is. I mean, I think crushing it in the AA world, you know, I'm doing this deal. I, you know, try to help some people and going to meetings, you know, and my wife are living the AA dream. You know, she's sober a long time. And I started getting off kind of the path in AA. You know, I started, this is what my life looks like, chasing the self-objective, the self-determined objective instead of this God objective. You know, I'm coming to meetings a little bit late, and I'm leaving a little early because I had purchased this business that I had no qualifications to buy, right? But I had this vision of grandeur, you know, time for me to be the boss. You know, I'm 32 or something like that. I can't remember how 18 minus 50. I'm 30 something, you know, and I figured, you know, if I can be the boss, get some power and I can make some more money, then I can decide what I make, you know, and it went to crap, you know, this whole business thing went to crap and the economy went to crap, you know, and I'm not really interested in the God objective. I mean, I want to stay sober, you know, I want to stay sober. But this relationship with God was kind of like this, like I'd almost figured out the system to God. You know, they told me what I had to do to stay here when I got here. John, you get up in the morning, say your prayers, you know, say the third set prayer, say the seventh set prayer, get on your knees, go about your day, go to a meeting, try to help somebody, you know, be a good husband, blah, blah, blah. At night, if you haven't taken a drink, say thank you, rinse, repeat, and keep going. And, you know, at the time, it was like this magic decoder ring that they get in the cereal box, right? I mean, just figure out the code, and it was working, you know, by the physical aspects, what you all told me was working, you know, but my spirit wasn't growing, you know. It didn't feel like I was getting closer to God, you know, and, man, I just started chasing self. You know, my experience is that self cannot be satiated. You know, I've never had enough sex. I've never had enough money. I've never had a big enough boat. I've never had a big enough house. I've never had anything that fills this, you know, God-sized hole in me. And I nearly died stone cold sober, man. I ruined everything in my life. You want to talk about I mean, I was in complete management. Everything that I touched went to crap, and it was all about self. You know, and at the time when the aftermath of this happening, you know, I kind of looked back, like, what in the hell happened? You know, I thought, man, did I miss the magic four-step? Did I miss a column? You know, did I miss this? You know, and it was really, I just let self take back over. You know, just, and you don't know it. You don't know it when self takes back over. I went for a little run, you know, after Leslie's talk. Well, that might be a little generous, a fast walk. And you know how the iPhone and iPads are, like, it'll tell you on your phone when you left something behind. You know, when you got, and if you got your earbuds in, it'll audibly tell you. And so I got around the building and down the street, and it says a device has been left behind, you know, 200 meters or whatever it tells you. I mean, I wish I had that like in early recovery, right? Like, you have left the boundary of God's will. You are now seeking self. Like I could use that, you know, even today. I forgot what I was talking about. Self. Yeah. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that's the root of all of our problems. And, you know, so I'm trying to make, you know, I'm just doing things, man, that are just trying to make myself feel better. And I'm full of so much fear, man. Fear is all over my character defects. I mean, it is my number one character defect. If you pull up the seven deadly sins, I don't know if that's on there, but man, I got it. You know, I think the big book is wrong in two places. I do, and that's one of them. Bill says 100 forms of fear. I had 327 this morning when I woke up, and I could probably give you another 327 forms of fear. I mean, fear is, you know, fear that you're not going to like me, fear that you will like me. You know what I mean? And when I went back through I'm getting ahead of myself. So I buy this business. It goes to crap. You know, we move a county north, you know, and I really don't get plugged into the AA, you know. And the guy I bought this business from was in AA, and it went south, and he had to repossess it. And I'm just going to tell you shortly, time's flying. In 1 year's period of time, John seeking self, this is what happened. I got arrested in sobriety for the third time for the same thing. I don't like paying my speeding tickets. And in the state of Maryland, they got this policy. If you don't pay them, they'll suspend your driver's license, which really isn't a big deal because you can still drive. Because you know, they don't come get it. You know, you just drive. They don't come get your car, you know. And unless they find you driving it, then they'll take your car. And this is the crazy thing. I'm like 16 or 17 years sober. There's the only story I got. I'm 16 or 17 years sober. I'm at dinner with a sponsee. It's the only one I had that stuck. and we're eating this fancy dinner that I can't afford, and he can't afford, certainly. And I'm telling him all these wonderful spiritual principles of AA. And he, you know, he went to his car, and I went to my car. And as I left the restaurant, I went the wrong way on a little ramp out of the shopping center. The cop pulled me over. And in no time at all, I'm behind, my hands behind my back, leaning against the car. You know, I'm waiting for my sponsee to fly by, like, call me tomorrow. Like, you know, I mean, I'm so full of, you know, I mean, it's just. So I get arrested in sobriety. I'm going bankrupt. My house is in foreclosure. My cars are repossessed. I got little kids, and my lights are being turned off. I mean, you know, you can lie to a three-year-old, but that nine-year-old figures it out. You know what I mean? You know, the three-year-old, I'm like, oh, they're doing construction down the street. They got to turn it off for a little while. You know, we're at Walmart, you know, getting Coleman lanterns, you know. And the kid's like, oh, we're going camping in our front yard. You know, it's just awful, you know. Cars are gone, you know, I'm just dying inside. And IRS bills, I got this business failing. I owe $600,000 on this house, you know, I mean on this business. And I got two garbage bags. That bill, you know, the ones you get at Christmas that you can fit like three pairs of shoes in? Lori knows those size, you know. And they're both stacked to the top with bills. And I can't even look. I mean, there could have been a check for $1 million in there, and I wouldn't know. I mean, there wouldn't have been. But, you know, I just could not. I couldn't even. I could walk in the room and not even know that. I mean, I have this ability with my character defects, like, just walk in a room and not even see anything. You know, just complete, you know, full flight from reality. And I traded in the thing that I was kind of most, not kind of, I traded in the thing that I was most proud of in my sobriety. I used to say all the time, you know, I've done a lot wrong in recovery, but I've never picked up, I've never been unfaithful to my wife. And I traded that in. This young woman that worked for me had a sister, and we were at this business lunch, and she was there, and she flirted with me, and I was so spiritually sick, I did not ignore it. And that was the beginning of a bottom that brought me really to 6 and 7. It absolutely devastated my wife. It devastated our family, you know, and we went on this path to recovery of doing something different, you know. And what happened was, after a few months of trying to recover from having an affair, which is nearly impossible, I mean, at least for a guy like me. But we were fighting it out. You know, we got a whole rack of small kids, and I just can't take it anymore. I still don't have a sponsor. I still don't have the solution, you know. I'm just going to meetings, you know, and I can't go to meetings in the county that we live now because she sponsors half the county. And every time I walk in, the women look at me like I got a scarlet letter on my head, you know. There's the guy that broke my sponsor. And I can't go to the county south where I got sober, where I screwed up that business, because the guy's in the program, I owe him $600,000, you know, so I can't go anywhere. I'm driving 2 hours in meetings where people don't even know who I am, you know, just to try to act like a newcomer, you know. And I just couldn't take it any longer. And 3 o'clock in the morning, I found myself on the kitchen crying like a schoolgirl. And of myself, chasing self, without this perfect objective that Bill talks about, the best thing I can come up with 18 years of sobriety, is rifle or shotgun. And I had this great moment of clarity. I'm sitting on this kitchen, I'm crying, and I just full of so much pity. Look at my life. Everything. I mean, there was not one, I'm not being exaggerated, there was not one area of my life that you could look at and pinpoint to give me a little hope. Like, hey, John, you're handling this part okay. I mean, there was nothing. I was like, hey, it doesn't work. And I heard this voice in the back of my head, not, you know, I don't think God talked to me, but I heard this truth in the back of my head, and it was like, dummy, you're not doing AA. And I looked at the last couple years of my life, like a movie scene, this fast forward clip, and I was like, holy, I am not doing this deal. And I made this great surrender that I've never made since. It was the 7-step prayer for me. I didn't know it, but it was the 7-step prayer. I used to say for the first 18 years of my sobriety, I used to say the 3rd-step prayer, the 7-step prayer. Sir, you have to stop yawning. I know it's after lunch, but you got to stop yawning. I'm going to start yawning too. I'm just teasing. I said this third set prayer and the seventh set prayer so fast, so often, it just didn't even mean anything to me anymore. I was no longer a seeker. You know, God, give me this. Hey, J-Man, how about a little extra in the paycheck this weekend? You know, the spiritual paycheck. You know, give me some goodies. I mean, it's kind of like what we do. I'll point out, when we said the Lord's Prayer after Leslie, how many said the prayer? I don't know. I know I'm guilty of not. You know, maybe first couple sentences, and then I'll start thinking about dinner, you know. And then I'll come back right at the end and give you a strong amen, you know, or something like that, you know. But I said this prayer. I think it was a stronger prayer than I'd ever said in my life. And it was, God, fix me or kill me. Do one of them quick. And that's when I, in hindsight, you know, became committed to this perfect objective that Bill talks about. And this perfect objective that Bill talks about is not about being perfect. It's about developing this ideal, this goal to shoot for, something other than the sex status and security that I'm, you know, so in love with, you know. I mean, my ego will just regenerate faster than anything. I mean, it's like, it's unbelievable. You know how, like, you see a little valley get crushed by a forest fire, you know, and the next day there's like a little seedling, like boop, like, I mean, that's my ego. It doesn't matter, you know. And so what I want to tell you about that is, well, one thing is talking about tapers. I got introduced through a tape, and I'm going to talk more about that tonight. But I got introduced to a guy that thought this crazy idea that our book was an instruction manual. And I tell you all that to tell you that going back through the steps, like with a new set of glasses, it was just an amazing process. You know, I seem to attract a lot of sponsees that have about 15 to 20 years of sobriety that, like, just train wreck their life. And, you know, I'll get a call from somebody, hey, this is Steve in, you know, Zimbabwe. You don't know me, but so-and-so said I needed to call you. And I go, uh-oh. What'd you do? Right? I mean, I know what's coming, you know. Well, I went bankrupt, and my wife threw me, you know, stone cold sober, you know. Not even having the excuse, well, I'm out there smoking crack, and she left me, you know. Like, not even that. But I made this great surrender. I mean, I meant it. I meant it with all my being. Lie detector test my butt. I meant it. And a month or so later, like, nothing had changed. Surrender does not equal change. And I met this old fool, and he got me into the book. Man, I just realized, like, I'm not even saying that I missed stuff. Just a new set of glasses, a new level of willingness. You know, that's why I think 3, 7, and 11 really are. It's just this new degree of willingness. You know, the third step, we're surrendering this idea that, you know, I can manage. I'm surrendering, as Leslie pointed out, you know, my thinking and my actions. But, like, we really don't know what that means, especially if we're getting quick into the steps, you know. And when I went back through the steps with this old man, I thought, I was convinced that the issue. So my wife and I are trying to recover from this affair, you know, and we're trying to figure this out, man. We saw the priest. I mean, if the Dalai Lama had been in town, we'd have seen him, you know. We saw every couple of therapists we could find. We read every book. I mean, we really wanted to make this work. We really wanted to fix John. And I'll say that. I mean, I'll just quickly say some opinion here. Like, you know, they say when something like that happens in a marriage that, you know, it's really a two-person affair. Like one person does not do that in a vacuum. You understand what I'm trying to say? And that's not my experience. Right, like there was nothing in my marriage that you could have pointed to, and these people who were telling us this were not in our program. You know, they don't understand the. Maybe they do, but that wasn't my case. I mean, I'm not telling you my wife is perfect. You know, but like there was nothing where I could look and be like, oh, she, you know, she didn't make me feel loved enough, or she didn't do her part, or like, I didn't have any of those excuses. Right, I mean. My wife is incredible, and you know. So we're going back through these steps with this new level of desire, and and about 3 months had gone by, and I finally got a hold of this guy, and we're going back through the book, and I thought that what I had missed was like the fourth step. I'd missed that. I didn't do that fourth column. I didn't pray down the list. That was the missing golden nugget. You know, that's what Cliff talked earlier about, you know, why we're here this weekend, you know, and I would come to weekends like this kind of looking for some golden nugget. You know, I'd look at who the speakers are. Oh, that guy sucks. I'm not listening to that one. This one's good. You know, I'm looking, you know, and the magic doesn't happen during these hours that someone gets up here and speak. That's not the magic. The magic happened in the I don't know how many 10 committee meetings that you had, you know, whole group of people getting together trying to serve their AA community. I'm telling you, much more magic happened in those 10 committee meetings than happened up here with, you know, what we've had to say by all stretch of the imagination. You know, the magic that happens in these things is out here, you know, by the coffee pot. When some new guy who got dragged here finally says, "Hey, man, can I talk to you for a minute? I'm dying." Or maybe it's the old timer who's been off the path, you know, for a long time, who finally says, "Man, I got to get back in the middle. You know, I've been chasing self, and I'm dying." You know, and but that wasn't it. It wasn't the magic fourth step. It wasn't the missing column for me. It was this cumulative package of all the steps, right? Like, so if I'm having problems with the sixth step, this entirely part and this all part, I got to look back to the previous step. Obviously, my fifth step was not searching and fearless. Because my fourth step wasn't searching and fearless if it did not create this fifth step that created this desire for me to go forward, right? Like at the end of five, it says, you know, real quickly, the prerequisites, you know, did we leave anything out? You know, did we make mortar without sand type of deal? These couple quick questions, you know, and I'll tell you, when I did my first really solid fifth step, the question was unmistakable. Yeah, I'm ready, right? I do this fifth step, and I got this smoldering pile of rubble in front of me that there's no other choice. Like, I can't deny what's happened. Thank God my sponsor, you know, I think the magic of the fifth step, because what happened to me for a long time, not what happened to me, what I did didn't happen to me. I would share 90% of what was going on in my life with everybody. Cliff's got 90, Steve's got 90, Matt's got 90. Because I know what you told me is true, that I'm only sick as my secrets, I can't have secrets. But I got this fear, again, that we keep talking about, that if somebody knows all of me, they're going to be like, let's not invite John tonight. I mean, that dude's, you know, crazy. And the wild thing is like, I have had a pathetic life. Like, there's no real bodies buried. It's all up here, right? I mean, like, what's the old saying? I'm not much, but I'm all I think about, you know? I mean, every time I've done a half-decent fifth step, you know, my sponsors have been like, "That it?" Like, yeah, I'm just pathetic, you know? I don't mean this in a self-deprecating way. I've had a pathetic life compared to what has been given to me. Like, I have had no trials put on me by the world. My wife, you know, didn't die of cancer. My kid wasn't born missing a leg, you know. In terms of, like, I haven't had these worldly tragedies. Like, all of the tragedies in my life have come from seeking self. Every single one of them. But yet, I'll go back time and time again. I mean, you're talking to a guy who's bought, like, 4 boats in 6 years. You know, I buy a boat, and I don't need, you know, sell the boat. I don't need a boat. I don't use a boat, you know. But then I find myself on the internet for, like, 12 hours watching boat porn. You know, like, I mean, you know, a lot of times speakers come up and they, you know, talk about, you know, the problems they used to have. I still got them. I'm going to tell you the truth. 36 years sober, I, you know, self is still an issue. And that's why I got to be in the middle of this thing. You know, I still got to have a sponsor. I'm talking regularly to. I got to have my road dogs. You know, my sponsor's greatest gift to me is his transparency. He'll call me with his stuff. I'm like, "You got the right number, dude?" Like, you know, he's like, "I got to talk to you." I'm like, "You did what?" You know, because I had this idea that sponsorship was like this some type of hierarchical system where, like, complaints and problems only went one direction. You know, I don't know why I got that idea, but I did. Thank you. My wife got me these glasses, but I'd rather hold the menu down here. Part of my full flight from reality of getting older. Getting old is a pit. Glasses, hearing aids, Viagra, blood pressure medicine. I mean, God bless. I'm not wearing the glasses. I'm not wearing the glasses all the time. My kids make a joke, like every family picture, you know, we have a little family thread and we text pictures everywhere. Every time, every picture, there's like seven pairs of like glasses that are casualties that are, you know, laying in the corner up on the shelf. And the, anyways, I'm not well yet. I found for me like, so I'm going back, you know, through the steps with this guy. And what I found, like, the thing that was really blocking me the most was this, my old ideas about God. You know, for a long time, my sobriety, I'm putting this, you know, we just, first time through the steps with my sponsor, we glazed through the second step. You know, the chapter says, I thought the chapter was titled, To the Agnostics. That's not what it says. It says, We Agnostics. I looked at it. I mean, it might as well be a chapter to the wives. I'm not a wife, so let's keep going. I'm not an agnostic. What I came to find out was that I was an agnostic. And there are moments in my day that I am an agnostic. And I'm going to give you that definition. So a Gnostic is somebody with experiential working knowledge of God, or the subject matter. Experiential working knowledge of. And so it's not a question of your faith and your belief system, but I would submit to you that if you had a working, effective relationship with the power greater than yourself, you would have tapped into that and not wound up in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? And there's still times where I act like an agnostic. I'm here to tell you, and I believe this with all my being, as I stand here before you, my relationship with God is the most important thing in my life. And I see a lot of heads nodding. But God, I sure have a tough time acting that way. Why don't I act that way? When I have this knowledge, why don't I act that way? Why aren't I kinder to the person that screws up, you know? I mean, the amount of people that I've withheld love and mercy and charity from is disgusting. I'm just telling you. Whether it be the crazy girl at my home group. You got one, sir. I see that. We might need to talk after the meeting. I heard this thing the other day I really liked. I'm going to steal it. He said, don't worry. God only calls us to love three types of people, three ways. Justly. All right, I can do that. So, like, justly is the people I'm supposed to love. My parents, my kids, easy. I can do that. And the second way is charitably. Those are the ones that I'm not too sure about. I don't know if my neighbor deserves it, but I will. You know, I heard they had a baby, so I'll bring over some cupcakes. Or, you know, the teenage girl or the middle-aged girl, whatever. Someone on the side of the road with a flat tire. You know, I don't know if they deserve my help, but I'm called to be charitable. So I'm going to stop and I'm going to do that. And then mercifully, I'm called to love those that don't deserve it. And that's really tough for a guy like me. Because I have these four things that I've kind of like seen that like stop me from humility, right? This seven-step prayer that we take, the seven-step and the 12 and 12 is all about humility, right? I after being given this assignment of 6 and 7, man, I got back into our 12 and 12. I hadn't read it in, you know, a little bit. You know, Bill uses the word humility 31 times in like six pages. Duh, right? Like, I might want to try some. But there, you know, I talk about there are four things that I need to surrender, and there's four, and they're the same things. They're the four things that stop me from having humility. And one is this need to be right, right? The need to be right does not coexist with humility. And you're probably sitting here saying, well, I really don't have that need to be right. Tell me about the last time you had a political conversation with somebody from the other side. Did you have a need to be right? You know, I'll tell you, I just learned this recently about myself. Like, my desire to cut my wife off mid-sentence is the need to be right, you know? Like, what you have to say doesn't matter. You're not seeing it my way, this need to be right. And it's, you know, this need to be right is painful. And it has absolutely no value. I'll share you a little story. My son, John, the love of my life, my baby boy, carries my name. He, when he was 17, he was getting ready to be a Boy Scout. Thanks to his mother, did some of his merit badge things, you know. She just cracked the whip until he got it, you know. She beat him into becoming a Boy Scout, you know. And so when you become a Boy Scout, you have until you're 18 years old and 0 days. One day after, you're out. No luck. And so you have to do a service project to become a Boy Scout, an Eagle Scout, excuse me, which is a big deal. And so he picked his project the very last minute, you know, because he's an Edmunds. And his was going to be, he's going to build this little campfire thing at the halfway house. And I thought that was really cool. And I kept telling him, John, you got to schedule this. You got to get some, because they had to go and ask people for money to do the thing. You know, you can't get the money from your parents. I kept, you know, I'm cracking the whip, nagging him. Laura, you understand. And I said, listen, man, in November, I got this, you know, men's retreat to go to. Like, we got, you know. Anyway, so he schedules this thing. And it is the weekend of my favorite weekend of the year. This men's retreat I go to, very special to my heart, 30 men. This retreat saved my life. And so he's like, hey, I scheduled it all myself. I'm like, great. You know, when is it? He's like, you know, whatever, November 9th. I'm like, buddy, that's my weekend. You know, I go to Nashville and I go to my sponsor. He's like, I know, Dad. And I start beating him up. I'm like, listen, this is not how the world works, son. You cannot, you know, fail to schedule something correctly and expect the world to readjust to help you. And he's like, I know, Dad, you're right. And I kept beating him. And he kept saying, you know, you're right. And so I was like, all right, well, now we got that clear, I'm right. And shit. And so I get on the plane and I go to this retreat and I'm sitting there. And it's Friday at 2 o'clock and I know exactly what's happening. He's at the halfway house with some guys doing the project. And I'm sitting at this stupid retreat and I know I'm right. And I don't want to be there. If I had the ability, which I don't, to charter a jet, pick me up in a helicopter, and drive me home that minute to make it in time, I would have, you know. And the problem with the needing to be right is, for me, it leads to this need to punish. Think about the last time you were at a restaurant and got terrible, terrible service. I had this little business, still have this little business. Me and my partner were doing really good, and we used to go to these fancy lunches every day, you know, big fat boy lunches, you know, $150 for the two of us, you know. Let's eat five lunches and three appetizers, two desserts, you know. And so we're at our regular place, Stanford Grill in Columbia, Maryland. Great place. We always sit at the bar. We sit at the same spots. We get the same girl to help us. We sit down, and our appetizer is already in the thing. You know, our drinks are already there. It's, you know, I know. It's pathetic. And so they got a different girl, and she does an awful job. I think this was her first day, not only as a waitress, but her first day in the workforce. I mean, you know, no silverware, no water, no drinks. Like, she got him the wrong meal, got me the wrong meal, and he starts, you know, taking forever, and we're getting worked up, you know, worked up. And my partner's getting really worked up, you know, because he doesn't have this thing that we have. And I was, you know, I was always the guy that paid, you know, I paid the bills for the company, and so she gives me the bill. And I'm getting ready, and I'm all pissed off. You know, so what do you tip her, you know? Zero, right? And I had this, like, quick moment of clarity that I had this opportunity to either just be right, punish her, or just to love her right where she was at. And the lunch was $125, and I gave her a $125 tip. And I didn't want my partner to see it. And we got in the car. He said, did you just tip that girl $125? And I said, yeah. And he said, what were you thinking? I said, Tony, God's been over-tipping me for bad service my entire life, right? That's that trying to love this, you know, in a merciful way. You know, the other one is this need to be powerful, you know. You think about it, like, what that looks like. It has a bunch of different faces, but like think about early sobriety when your sponsee doesn't do what you tell them to do. You know, I remember yelling at my sponsor, I told him to call me every day. You know, like, come on. But it showed up recently. I sponsor this guy with long time, 25 years plus. And he started sponsoring this guy at the halfway, at the treatment center that we go to. And in short order, I figured out, not by investigating, but like I found out this guy was not taking him through the four step the way that I took him through. And I'm bent out of shape. I'm like, you know, I mean, I'm not bent out of shape. I'm not giving a hard time, but like, it's going on up here, you know. I got this, you know, this need to be powerful, which is weird because I don't like having power at work, right? Like the joke is, if you really like power, you're the one who's the slave. If you're the boss, you're telling everybody what to do. You have to tell them what to do. If you're just the guy that paints the ceiling, when you get to work, you go, which ceiling, boss? Right? He goes, that one, and you start painting. You know, the two I'm going to glaze over real quick is this need to be effective, which is like kind of like this need for praise. Like we were talking about it. I forgot who it was. We were talking about it earlier. Like I have such a fear of failure. If I am not relatively 99% certain that I'm going to be successful, I'm not playing the game. Like I'm just not. If I can't be the king of the idiots, I don't want to play. You know, which is really showed its face for me. You know, like, I don't know if a lot of you guys go to the treatment centers or stuff like that, but like where I really learned this first one was this need to be effective. My friend is down the director of the Salvation Army in D.C. They have like a 600-bed facility. He says, John, I want you to come down and talk. So I show up and talk. It's a room this big, at least as big, probably twice as deep. And Monday night, and he says, all right, you know, so come down. And we're sitting in his office talking before the meeting. I said, how many guys are you expecting? And he's like, I don't know. We made it optional. I don't know why you make meetings optional at the treatment center, but hey, I'm not in charge. And, you know, there's a football game on. And I'm sitting in this room, I'm telling you, that holds 600 people, and six guys show up. And they're all in the back. And they're all like this. The entire hour. And I was shook up. I guarantee it was one of the worst talks I ever gave, right? Because I had this need for somebody to nod their head, somebody to look at me in the eye, not yawn, no problem, sir. You know? I mean, I just had, like, I need my wife to pat me on the head and say, you know, good job, you know? I mean, there's one thing I don't do, and that's vacuum, right? But the few times a century that I vacuum and my wife's gone, you know, like, because she's always complaining about the dog hair. We're never getting another dog. I mean, she loves my dog. She's like, we're not getting another dog. I'm like, yeah, we're getting another dog. So there's one day, I'm like, I'm going to vacuum. And I knew she was going to be home about 5 minutes. I did not put that vacuum away. I left that vacuum dead center. She walked in the house. She goes, did you break the vacuum? I said, oh, no. I left it out. I've been vacuuming all day. I just left it out. I did not dream I was going to come close to running out of time. This fourth one is this need to possess, like this idea that, like, I got to have something. Like, it's mine. And we all know, right? Like, we don't take anything with us. And this lesson became really clear for me when my wife and I are trying to, you know, rebuild our marriage and lead a godly life. We went a long time without, you know, I told you our house in foreclosure, but it was during that crisis, you know. We didn't pay a mortgage payment for 2.5 years, and somehow we were able to stay in that house. And we just gave that house to God and AA and newcomers and big book studies. We had a guy down in the basement getting sober, you know, and, you know, we just rocked it. We said, everything's God's, you know. Everything's God's. And you got to be careful when you say it out loud. He will take you up on it. So I let this girl, you know, so things are kind of financially repairing a little bit. And I lent this girl that works for me, underneath me, you know, $500. And she didn't pay me back. You know, she's a single mom, you know, 300 kids or something. You know, she's paycheck to paycheck. I mean, I know I'm never getting that money back, you know, but I was getting ready to go on vacation. I wanted that $500. And, like, every Friday she's like, well, you know, this is, you know, there's a problem. And I, you know, But there's one, so I'm pissed, you know, because it's my money. So I break up my phone. I got it all caps. And this is back before, like, the iPhone had the function where you could do automatic all caps. So you got to hit the arrow and then the letter, arrow and then letter. So I'm like, tap, 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 tap. And I'm like, how dare you? You are stealing from me. You are taking food from my children's mouths. You are stealing my money. And I, that was truth in the back of my head said, God does not speak to me. Do not. But there was this great truth, and it was, John, if everything is God's, she can't steal from you. And that was the truth. And I had to learn that little lesson because my wife's mother and I were not friends. The resentment ran deep. I used to be a golfing whore. I will golf anywhere, anytime, with anybody, at any cost, doesn't matter where it is. And we used to go down to Myrtle Beach, golf capital of the United States, and we'd play 10 rounds in 5 days. And her mom lived in Myrtle Beach. And so we'd go down to Myrtle Beach, and I'd come back, and the kids would say, hey, did you see Grandma while you were down there? And I'd say, no, I didn't see Grandma. But after a couple of years, we used to do that like 2-3 times a year. You know, so after a dozen times, one of the kids figures it out. Like, why don't you see Grandma while you're down there? And I said, listen, if your grandma, if I caught on fire next to your grandmother's pool, I wouldn't jump in it, okay? That's how deep the resentment was. My wife, you know, they had a really abusive relationship. My wife would go down there. My wife would come back in pieces, just, you know, just a wreck. And so my wife's mother got sick, and she had peripheral artery disease. Like, her veins were no longer pumping to her legs, and, you know, she lost function of her legs, and she started losing toes and stuff, and what happened in this transformation in doing this deal that we do, we had had many talks. She said, I know when my mom gets sick, she can't come here at the end. I know she can't. I'm glad you know that, because she can't. And she got sick. And my wife brought her up to a you know, rehab center a couple months near us, and they're like, take her home. And my wife called me up, and she says, I'm bringing my mom home. I said, bring her home. You know, and I was able to love this woman, love the unlovable, you know. She had known me, whatever, 30 years, you know, 28 years, and I hadn't seen her in a decade. And in that time, I had done this work that we talk about. And she died in our dining room where my wife could take care of her. And after a week of being there, she said to my wife, she said, that's not the same man I knew before I went down to South Carolina, and that's because of you people. I want to tell you a couple things in the few hours that I have left about what living on this other side has done. You know, living just poorly aimed at this perfection ideal that Bill talks about, this perfect ideal, this godly ideal, trying to live a life of love and mercy and charity, just poorly trying to do it, some amazing things have happened. You know, if AA were a self-help group right now, I would say you can have anything you want. You can be anything you want. You can do anything you want. I don't think that's true. But what I know for certain is that God can do anything with you. God can do remarkable things with you. I want to tell you two things that he's done with me. One, I told you fear is my deal, right? I'm a scaredy cat. I'm a scaredy cat. And I went to the nation's first recovery high school in Maryland. The judge sentenced me there. And it stayed open for about 15 years. And it burned down. They never opened up a new one. And this group in Washington, D.C. wanted to start another one. And that faltered. I got to do this in about 5 minutes. And so there was a couple people in Maryland that I had taken to their meetings that were interested in starting this recovery high school. This woman that I used to take down there, and it was just heavy on my heart. Like, hey, we got to try to do this. We got to try to start a recovery high school. And so Sarah, this woman that my wife sponsors, we were out doing a group inventory in Baltimore. And I said, hey, you know we got to do this, right? She's like, ugh. I knew you were going to say this at some point. I was like, we just got to do it. And She's like, where are we going to get the money? And I'm like, I don't know. That's God's business. And she's, and I didn't, that answer just came out of my mouth. She said, where are we going to get a building? I said, I don't know. That's God's business too. You know, where are we going to get these kids from? I said, I don't know. That's God's business too. It was kind of like that old baseball movie with Kevin Costner. What's it called? Field of Dreams. And so we just trusted God in this process, and we started the process. And so we raised a bunch of money, you know, and you know, a couple hundred thousand bucks, not enough to sustain a school for a long time. And so we said, hey, as soon as we get close to $300,000, we're going to sign a lease on a building. And so we got $201,000, and we go sign a lease on this building. And we brought this huge donor by, and this guy's worth hundreds of millions of dollars. And this was like the first couple of days of July. And I could tell right away he's not interested. He is out of this deal. He was a real estate developer. But his wife was in, and so I started selling her. And so we sit down afterwards, you know, and, you know, we give him the breakout the checkbook deal. He's like, this is a terrible idea. I'm not interested. His name was Marvin. And he said, I'm not interested. I love what you guys are doing, but this building is going to cost. He said, you signed a lease on this building? I said, yeah, I signed a lease on this building. He said, this building is going to eat you alive. He said, how much do you have? I'm like, well, we got close to $300,000. He's like, put a zero on that. I'm like, oh, my. So he calls me July 3rd, and he says, you know, I've been thinking about how I can help you guys because I love what you're doing. My son was in recovery, blah, blah, blah. And I said, yeah, I appreciate it. You know, he said, do you think you can get out of the lease? I said, oh, yeah, I get out of the lease. And, yeah, that's what we do, right? Pack up the glad bags and go. No, I was gonna do it the right way. I said, I can get out of that lease. He said, well, if you can get out of that lease, I'll get out of that lease. He said, I got three properties that I thought might be useful to you. And he named two. And the third one was perfect. It was right in downtown Frederick where we live, near the bus stop, near the train station, right near the AA coffee shop. Other block is the AA club. I was like, that's the one we want. He's like, well, I don't know. He's grilling me back and forth, blah, blah, blah. So we hang up, and he calls me 2 days later, July 5th. My AA birthday. And he says, it didn't have anything to do with me. He said, what do you think? I said, well, you know, I looked up the building and I said, you know, he had bought this building because the building next door he gave to the YMCA, he bought that building for $20 million. And this building was $2 million. And I said, I've done the math, $2 million, like, at minimum, that's $10,000 a month rent. I said, it's out of our range. He said, I'm going to give you the building. He said, if you can keep that school open for 5 years, we'll give you the building. And that whole time, every step of the way in this whole process of opening this school, I'm a guy who got thrown out of high school. My name is on a license in a high school in Maryland right now. I have the authority to sign diplomas. We talk about irony. Only all God's work, right? Every step of the way, I'm doubting Thomas. This can't happen. This is not going to work. This is not going to work. This is not going to work. And it just happened. I mean, I was 20 people were on this committee. This amazing thing happened. 2 years later, we graduated our first student diploma. This last May, she graduated from the University of Vermont, 6 years sober. She went to a sober dorm up there. Like, all because I put fear aside for a second and just put one foot in the other. This last little 2 minutes that I have, I want to talk about fear in my life just even today. Last summer, I got this wild hair at my backside. I'm going to go to college. And I'd never been to college. When I was 19 years old, I conned some money out of my grandmother to go to college. She's like, how much are the courses? I'm like, they're 150. I need to go to 10 of them. Give me 1,500. So I enlisted in one, kept the 1,350, and stone cold sober. And I got to the parking lot. And I cried my eyes out because I could not go inside. I could not go inside. And I left, you know, man, you're a loser, all this stuff. So I got this hair up my thing, you know, last summer. I'm like, someone told me about this program. Like, you can fill out this form and give them your work history, and they'll give you credits. And I got ADD bad, you know. And so I get all the paperwork, and I'm sitting at my desk, and, like, there's, like, three forms, and all day long, you know, I'm, like, trying to get this paperwork done, you know. I got emails going, phone going, text going, dog going, you know. I'm not getting anywhere. And I caught Cliff, man. Tore up. I mean, I'm tore up. I mean, it was like I'm 19 years old again, sitting in this parking lot. And he's like, "What's going on?" I said, "I think I need to go on ADD meds. I need some Adderall." He's like, "What'd you say?" I'm like, "Yeah, they got this slow release stuff. You know, it's not, you know, it's sober." He's like, "I don't know." I was like, "Well, I can't, you know." He's like, "Why don't you talk to some people about it first?" And so my son was on the slow release Adderall during high school. I said, "Hey, I got to ask you a question." I said, "What do you think about this Adderall?" I said, "You know, I'm trying to go." He said, "No." He said, "You cannot take Adderall." I was like, "I didn't even finish." He's like, "No, you know." And I didn't get anywhere. And my daughter calls me up, one of my heroes, this little lawyer, and she says, "How's the paperwork coming?" And I said, "Well, it's not really. I don't know if I'm going to do it or not." She said, "I'm coming over Sunday. I'm going to help you." I said, "All right." So I got the paperwork out. You know, she comes to my office. We're sitting there. She's like, "Is this how you try to do paperwork?" I said, "What are you talking about?" She says, "You got your computer open, your phone open, you're playing with the dog. She's like, "Turn everything off and do the paperwork." And like one box at a time, she's like, "What's your name?" I'm like, so I do the paperwork. You know, I stand here before you like a year and a half later, like I got 93 credits and a 4.0, right? Like only, I'm telling you, man, like that is zero to do with John. That is zero to do with John. And this, you know, that need to be effective we talked about earlier, like, you know, I took this class and like nearly killed this professor to get an A, you know, but like God's grace is amazing. God's power is amazing. Like he, as the book talks about, you know, both you and the new man must walk day by day. And if you do, remarkable things will happen. And that's been my experience. I can't wait to spend an hour with you guys later. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and thank you for my life.